Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to the 172nd of the Cthulhu Podcasts. I'm FNH. Today we're starting off with the third part of the 39 Steps, and then we'll have a musical number from way later than usual, 1930. And then on to part 8 of our classic tale of horror. Let's get started. Chapter 3. The Adventure of the Literary Innkeeper. I had a solemn time travelling north that day. It was fine May weather, with the hawthorn flowering on every hedge, and I asked myself why, when I was still a free man, I had stayed on in London and not got the good of this heavenly country. I didn't dare face the restaurant car, but I got a luncheon basket at Leeds and shared it with the fat woman. Also, I got the morning's papers, with news about starters for the derby and the beginnings of the cricket season, and some paragraphs about how the Balkan affairs were settling down and a British squadron was going to Kiel. When I'd done with them, I got out Scudder's little black pocketbook and studied it. It was pretty well filled with jottings, chiefly figures, though now and then a name was printed in. For example, I found the words Hofgaard, Loonville, and Avocado pretty often, and especially the word Pavia. Now I was certain that Scudder never did anything without a reason, and I was pretty sure that there was a cipher in all this. That is a subject that has always interested me, and I did a bit of it myself once as an intelligence officer at Delagoa Bay during the Boer War. I have a head for things like chess and puzzles, and I used to reckon myself pretty good at finding out ciphers. This one looked like the numerical type, where sets of figures correspond to the letters of the alphabet. But any fairly shrewd man can find the clue to that sort after an hour or two's work, and I didn't think Scudder would have been content with anything so easy. So I fastened on the printed words, for you can make a pretty good numerical cipher if you have a key word which gives you the sequence of the letters. I tried for hours, but none of the words answered. And then I fell asleep, and woke at Dumfries just in time to bundle out and get into a slow Galloway train. There was a man on the platform whose looks I didn't like, but he never glanced at me, and when I caught sight of myself in the mirror of an automatic machine, I didn't wonder. With my brown face, my old tweeds and my slouch, I was the very model of one of the hill farmers who were crowding into the third-class carriages. I travelled with half a dozen in the atmosphere of shag and clay pipes. They'd come from the weekly market and their mouths were full of prices. I heard accounts of how the lambing had gone up in the Cairn and the Douch, and a dozen other mysterious waters. Above half the men had lunched heavily and were highly flavoured with whisky, but they took no notice of me. We rumbled slowly into a land of little wooded glens, and then to a great wide moorland place, gleaming with lochs with high blue hills showing northwards. About 5 o'clock the carriage had emptied, and I was left alone as I had hoped. I got out at the next station, a little place whose name I scarcely noticed, yet right in the heart of a bog. It reminded me of one of those forgotten little stations in the Karoo. An old station master was digging in his garden, and with a spade over his shoulder, sauntered to the train, took charge of a parcel, and went back to his potatoes. A child of 10 received my ticket, and I emerged on a white road that straggled over the brown moor. It was a gorgeous spring evening, and every hill was showing as clear as a cut amethyst. The air had the queer, rooty smell of bogs, but it was as fresh as mid-ocean, and it had the strangest effect on my spirits. I actually felt light-hearted. I might have been a boy out for a spring holiday tramp instead of a man of 37, very much wanted by the police. I felt just as I used to feel when I was starting for a big trek on a frosty morning on the High Veld. If you believe me, I swung along that road whistling. There was no plan of campaign in my head, only just to go on and on in this blessed, honest-smelling hill country for every mile put me in a better humour with myself. In a roadside planting, I cut a walking stick of hazel, and presently struck off the highway on a bypath which followed the glen of a brawling stream. I reckoned that I was still far ahead of any pursuit, and for that night might please myself. It was some hours since I had tasted food, and I was getting very hungry when I came to a herd's cottage set in a nook beside a waterfall. A brown-faced woman was standing by the door and greeted me with the kindly shyness of the moorland places. When I asked for a night's lodging, she said I was welcome to the bed in the loft, and very soon she set before me a hearty meal of ham and eggs and scones and thick sweet milk. At the darkening, her man came in from the hills, a lean giant, who in one step covered as much ground as 3 paces of ordinary mortals. They asked me no questions, for they had the perfect breeding of all dwellers in the wilds, but I could see they set me down as a kind of dealer, and I took some trouble to confirm their view. I spoke a lot about cattle, of which my host knew little, and I picked up from him a good deal about the local Galloway markets, which I tucked away in my memory for future use. At 10 I was nodding in my chair, and the bed in the loft received a weary man who never opened his eyes till 5 o'clock and set the little homestead a-going once more. They refused any payment, and by 6 o'clock I had breakfasted and was striding southwards again. My notion was to return to the railway line a station or two further back than the place where I had alighted yesterday, and to double back. I reckoned that that was the safest way, for the police would naturally assume that I was always making farther from London in the direction of some western port. I thought I still had a good bit of a start, for, as I reasoned, it would take some hours to fix the blame on me, and several more to identify the fellow who got on board the train at St. Pancras. It was the same jolly clear spring weather, and I simply could not contrive to feel careworn. Indeed, I was in better spirits than I had been for months, and over a long ridge of moorland I took my road, skirting the side of a high hill which the herd had called Cainsmore of Fleet. Nesting curlews and plovers were crying everywhere, and the links of green pasture by the streams were dotted with young lambs. All the slackness of the past months was slipping by in my bones, for I stepped out like a 4-year-old. By and by I came to a swell of moorland which dipped to the vale of a little river, and a mile away in the heather I saw the smoke of a train. The station, when I reached it, proved to be an ideal thing for my purpose. The moor surged up around it and left room only for the single line, the slender siding, and a waiting room, an office, and the station master's cottage, and a tiny yard of gooseberries and sweet William. There seemed no road to it from anywhere, and to increase the desolation, the waves of a tarn lapped on their grey granite beach 1/2 mile away. I waited in the deep heather until I saw the smoke of an east-going train on the horizon, and then I approached the tiny booking office and took a ticket for Dumfries. The only occupants of the carriage were an old shepherd and his dog, a wall-eyed brood that I mistrusted. The man was asleep, and on the cushions beside him was the morning's Scotsman. Eagerly I seized on it, for I fancied it would tell me something. There were 2 columns about the Portland Place murder, as it was called. My man, Paddock, had given the alarm and had the milkman arrested. Poor devil, it looked as if the latter had earned his sovereign hardly. But for me, he had been cheap at the price, for he seemed to have occupied the police for the better part of the day. In the latest news, I found a further instalment of the story. The milkman had been released, I read, and the true criminal, about whose identity the police were reticent, was believed to have got away from London by one of the northern lines. There was a short note about me as the owner of the flat. I guess the police had stuck that in as a clumsy contrivance to persuade me that I was unsuspected. There was nothing else in the paper, nothing about foreign politics or Carolides, or the things that had interested Scudder. I laid it down, and found that we were approaching the station at which I had got out yesterday. The potato-digging station-master had been gingered up into some activity, for the west-going train was waiting to let us pass, and from it had descended 3 men who were asking him questions. I supposed that they were the local police who had been stirred up by Scotland Yard, and had traced me as far as this one-horse siding. Sitting well back in the shadow, I watched him carefully. One of them had a book and took down notes. The old potato digger seemed to have turned peevish, but the child who had collected my ticket was talking volubly. All the party looked out across the moor where the white road departed. I hoped they were going to take up my tracks there. As we moved away from that station, my companion woke up. He fixed me with a wandering glance, kicked his dog viciously, and inquired where he was. Clearly, he was very drunk. "That's what comes of being a teetotaler," he observed in bitter regret. I expressed my surprise that in him I should have met a blue-ribbon stalwart. "Aye, but I'm a strong teetotaler," he said pugnaciously. "I took the pledge last Martimus, and have not touched a drop of whisky since. Not even at Hogmanay, though I was sore tempted." He swung his heels up onto the seat, and burrowed a frowsy head into the cushions. "And that's a what I get," he moaned. "A head better than fire, and twee in looking different ways for Sabbath."
"What did it?" I asked.
"A drink they call brandy. Being a teetotaler, I keep it off the whisky, but I was nip in a day at this brandy. And I doubt I'll be will for a fortnight." His voice died away into a splutter, and sleep once more laid its heavy hand on him. My plan had been to get out at some station down the line, but the train suddenly gave me a better chance, for it came to a standstill at the end of a culvert which spanned a brawling porter-coloured river. I looked out and saw that every carriage window was closed and no human figure appeared in the landscape. So I opened the door and dropped quickly into the tangle of hazels which edged the line. It would have been all right, but for that infernal dog. Under the impression that I was decamping with its master's belongings, it started to bark, and all but got me by the trousers. This woke up the herd, who stood bawling at the carriage door in the belief that I had committed suicide. I crawled through the thicket, reached the edge of the stream, and in cover of the bushes put 100 yards or so behind me. Then, from my shelter, I peered back, and saw the guard and several passengers gathered round the open carriage door and staring in my direction. I could not have made a more public departure if I had left with a bugler and a brass band. Happily, the drunken herd provided a diversion. He and his dog, which was attached by a rope to his waist, suddenly cascaded out of the carriage, landed on their heads on the track, and rolled some way down the bank towards the water. In the rescue which followed, the dog bit somebody, for I could hear the sound of a hard swearing. Presently they had forgotten me, and when, after a quarter of a mile's crawl, I ventured to look back, the train had started again and was vanishing in the cutting. I was in a wide semicircle of moorland, with the brown river as radius and the high hills forming the northern circumference. There was not a sign or sound of a human being, only the plashing of water and the interminable crying of curlews. Yet, oddly enough, for the first time, I felt the terror of the hunted on me. It was not the police that I thought of, but the other folk, who knew that I knew Scudder's secret and dared not let me live. I was certain that they would pursue me with a keenness and a vigilance unknown to the British law, and that once their grip closed on me, I should find no mercy. I looked back, but there was nothing in the landscape. The sun glinted on the metals of the line and the wet stones in the stream, and you could not have found a more peaceful sight in the world. Nevertheless, I started to run. Crouching low in the runnels of the bog, I ran till the sweat blinded my eyes. The mood did not leave me till I had reached the rim of the mountains and flung myself panting on a ridge high above the young waters of the Brown River. From my vantage ground, I could scan the whole moor right away to the railway line and to the south of it where the green field took the place of the heather. I have eyes like a hawk, but I could see nothing moving in the whole countryside. Then I looked east beyond the ridge and saw a new kind of landscape. Shallow green valleys with plentiful fir plantations and the faint lines of dust which spoke of high roads. Last of all, I looked into the blue May sky, and there I saw that which set my pulses racing. Low down, in the south, a monoplane was climbing into the heavens. I was as certain as if I had been told that the aeroplane was looking for me, and that it did not belong to the police. For an hour or two, I watched it from a pit of heather. It flew low along the hilltops, and then in narrow circles over the valley up which I had come, and then it seemed to change its mind,
rose to a great height and flew back way to the south. I did not like this espionage from the air, and I began to think less well of the countryside I had chosen for a refuge. These heather hills were no sort of cover if my enemies were in the sky, and I must find a different kind of sanctuary. I looked with more satisfaction to the green country beyond the ridge, for there I should find woods and stone houses. About 6 in the evening, I came out of the moorland to a white ribbon of road which wound up the narrow vale of the lowland stream. As I followed it, fields gave place to bent, and the glen became a plateau, and presently I had reached a kind of pass where a solitary house smoked in the twilight. The road swung over a bridge, and leaning on the parapet was a young man. He was smoking a long clay pipe and studying the water with spectacled eyes. In his left hand was a small book with a finger marking the place. Slowly he repeated, "As when a griffin through the wilderness, with winged step o'er hill and moory dale, pursues the Aramapazian." He jumped round as my step rung on the keystone, and I saw a pleasant sunburnt boyish face. "Good evening to you," he said gravely. "It's a fine night for the road." The smell of peat smoke and of some savoury roast floated to me from the house. "Is that place an inn?" I asked. "At your service," he said politely. "I am the landlord, sir, and I hope you will stay the night, for to tell the truth, I've had no company for a week." I pulled myself up on the parapet of the bridge and filled my pipe. I began to detect an ally. "You're young to be an innkeeper," I said. "My father died a year ago and left me the business. I live there with my grandmother. It's a slow job for a young man, and it wasn't my choice of profession." "Which was?" He actually blushed. "I want to write books," he said. "And what better chance could you ask?" I cried. "Man, I've often thought that an innkeeper would make the best storyteller in the world." "Not now," he said eagerly. "Maybe in the old days when you had pilgrims and ballad makers and highwaymen and mail coaches on the road. But not now. Nothing comes here but motor cars full of fat women who stop for lunch and a fisherman or two in the spring and the shooting tenants in August. There is not much material to be got out of that. I want to see life, to travel the world and to write things like Kipling and Comrade. But the most yet that I've done is to get some verses printed in Chambers' journal." I looked at the inn standing golden in the sunset against the brown hills. "I've knocked a bit about the world, and I wouldn't despise such a hermitage. Do you think that adventure is found only in the tropics or among the gentry in red shirts? Maybe you're rubbing shoulders with it at this moment." "That's what Kipling says," he said, his eyes brightening, and he quoted some verse about romance bringing up the 9:15. "Here's a true tale for you then," I cried, "and a month from now you can make a novel out of it." Sitting on the bridge in the soft May gloaming, I pitched him a lovely yarn. It was true in essentials too, though I altered the minor details. I made out that I was a mining magnate from Kimberley, who'd had a lot of trouble with IDB and had shown up a gang. They had pursued me across the ocean and had killed my best friend and were now on my tracks. I told the story well, though I say it who shouldn't. I pictured a flight across the Kalahari to German Africa, and crackling, parching days, and the wonderful blue velvet nights. I described an attack on my life on the voyage home, and I made a really horrid affair of the Portland Place murder. "You're looking for adventure," I cried. "Well, you found it here. The devils are after me and the police are after them. It's a race that I mean to win." "By God," he whispered, drawing his breath in sharply. "It is all pure Rider Haggard and Conan Doyle." "You believe me," I said gratefully. "Of course I do," and he held out his hand. "I believe everything of the common. The only thing to disrupt is the normal." He was very young, but he was the man for my money. "I think they're off my track for the moment, but I must lie close for a couple of days. Can you take me in?" He caught my elbow in his eagerness and drew me towards the house. "You can lie as snug here as if you were in a moss hole. I'll see that nobody blabs either. And you'll give me some more material about your adventures." As I entered the inn porch, I heard from far off the beat of an engine. There, silhouetted against the dusky west, was my friend, the monoplane. He gave me a room at the back of the house with a fine outlook over the plateau, and he made me free with his own study, which was stacked with cheap editions of his favourite authors. I never saw the grandmother, so I guessed she was bedridden. An old woman called Margit brought me meals, and the innkeeper was around at all hours. I wanted some time to myself, so I invented a job for him. He had a motor bicycle, and I sent him off the next morning for the daily paper, which usually arrived with the post in the late afternoon. I told him to keep his eyes skinned and make note of any strange figures he saw, keeping a special sharp lookout for motors and aeroplanes, and then I sat down in real earnest to Scudder's notebook. He came back at midday with the Scotsman. There was nothing in it except some further evidence of Paddock and the milkman and a repetition of yesterday's statement that the murderer had gone north. But there was a long article reprinted from The Times about Carolides and the state of affairs in the Balkans, though there was no mention of any visit to England. I got rid of the innkeeper for the afternoon, for I was getting very warm in my search for the cipher. As I told you, it was a numerical cipher, and by an elaborate system of experiments, I had pretty well discovered that there were nulls and stops. The trouble was the key word, and when I thought of the odd million words that he might have used, I felt pretty hopeless. But about 3 o'clock, I had a sudden inspiration. The name Julia Cecchini flashed across my memory. Scudder had said it was the key to the Carolides business, and it occurred to me to try it on his cipher. It worked. The five letters of Julia gave me the position of the vowels. A was J, the 10th letter of the alphabet, and so represented by the X in the cipher. E was XXI, and so on. Cecchini gave me the numerals for the principal consonants. I scribbled that scheme on a bit of paper and sat down to read Scudder's pages. In half an hour, I was reading with a whitish face and fingers that drummed on the table. I glanced out the window and saw a big touring car coming up the glen towards the inn. It drew up at the door, and there was the sound of people alighting. There seemed to be two of them, men in aquascutums and tweed caps. 10 minutes later, the innkeeper slipped into the room, his eyes bright with excitement. "There's two chaps below, looking for you," he whispered. "They're in the dining room having whiskies and sodas. They asked about you. They said they had hoped to meet you here. Oh, and they described you jolly well, down to your boots and shirt. I told them you had been here last night and had gone off on a motor bicycle this morning. And one of the chaps swore like a navvy. I made him tell me what they looked like. One was a dark-eyed, thin fellow with bushy eyebrows, and the other was always smiling and lisped in his talk. Neither was any kind of a foreigner. On this, my young friend was positive. I took a bit of paper and wrote these words in German as if they were part of a letter. Black stone. Scudder had got on to this, but he could not act for a fortnight. I doubt if I could do any good, especially as Carolides is uncertain about his plans. But if Mr. T advises, I will do the best I—" I manufactured it rather neatly, so that it looked like a loose page of private letter. "Take this down and say it was found in my bedroom, and ask them to return it to me if they overtake me." 3 minutes later, I heard the car begin to move, and peeping from behind the curtain, I caught sight of the two figures. One was slim, the other was sleek. That was the most I could make of my reconnaissance. The innkeeper appeared in great excitement. "Your paper woke them up," he said gleefully. "The dark fellow went as white as death and cursed like blazes, and the fat one whistled up and looked ugly. They paid for their drinks with half a sovereign and wouldn't wait for the change." "Now I'll tell you what I want you to do," I said. "Get on your bicycle and go off to Newton Stewart, to the chief constable. Describe the two men and say you suspect them of having something to do with the London murder. You can invent some reasons. The two will come back, never fear. Not tonight, for they'll follow me 40 miles along the road, but first thing tomorrow morning. Tell the police to be here bright and early." He set off like a docile child while I worked at Scudder's notes. When he came back, we dined together, and in common decency I had to let him pump me. I gave him a lot of stuff about lion hunts and the Matabele War, thinking all the while what tame businesses these were compared to this that I was now engaged in. When he went to bed, I sat up and finished Scudder. I smoked in a chair till daylight, for I could not sleep. About 8 the next morning, I witnessed the arrival of 2 constables and a sergeant. They put their car in a coach house under the innkeeper's instructions and entered the house. 20 minutes later, I saw from my window a second car come across the plateau from the opposite direction. It did not come up to the inn, but stopped 200 yards off in the shelter of a patch of woods. I noticed that its occupants carefully reversed it before leaving it. A minute or two later, I heard their steps on the gravel outside the window. My plan had been to lie hid in my bedroom and see what happened. I had a notion that if I could bring the police and my other more dangerous pursuers together, something might work out to my advantage. But now I had a better idea. I scribbled a line of thanks to my host, opened the window, and dropped quietly into a gooseberry bush. Unobserved, I crossed the dike, crawled down the side of the tributary burn, and won the high road on the far side of the patch of trees. There stood the car, very spick and span in the morning sunlight, but with the dust on her, which told of a long journey. I started her, jumped into the chauffeur's seat, and stole gently out onto the plateau. Almost at once the road dipped, so that I lost sight of the inn, but the wind seemed to bring me the sound of angry voices. Today's music is by Chester Gaylord, and it's a track called Any Time's the Time to Fall in Love.
Why do you keep on stalling when I'm calling every night? Why do you keep me waiting, speculating, is it right? You say you love and yet you quite forget you must decide. If you don't make up your mind, someday you'll wake up and find there's a time for everything. But everyone who's sane knows any time's the time to fall in love. Hearts are eager in the spring, for love as every swain knows, not dependent on the mood above. Cupid is not swayed by the weather. What does he care, dear, if it rains? Every plan we make together may not work out, still love remains. Set the date, don't hesitate, but just make up your mind, dear. Now's the time to fall in love with me. But is not swayed by the weather. What does he care, dear, if it rains? Every plan we make together may not work out, still love remains. So set the date, don't hesitate, but just make up your mind, dear. Now's the time to fall in love with me.
and so on to today's main feature. This is part 8 of Algernon Blackwood's The Wendigo. Part 8. Then at length, the darkness, having thus laboriously conceived, brought forth a figure. It drew forward into the zone of uncertain light where fire and shadows mingled, not 10 feet away, and then halted, staring at them fixedly. The same instant, it started forward again with the spasmodic motion as if a thing moved by wires, and coming up closer to them full into the glare of the fire, they perceived then that it was a man, and apparently that this man was Defago. Something like the skin of horror almost perceptibly drew down in that moment over every face, and 3 pairs of eyes shone it, as though they saw across the frontiers of normal vision and into the unknown. Defago advanced, his tread faltering and uncertain. He made his way straight up to them as a group first, and then turned sharply and peered close into the face of Simpson. The sound of a voice issued from his lips. "Here I am, Boss Simpson. I heard someone's calling me." It was a faint, dried-up voice, made wheezy and breathless as by an immense exertion. "I'm having a regular hellfire kind of a trip, I am." And he laughed, thrusting his head forward into the other's face. But that laugh started the machinery of the group of waxwork figures with the wax-white skins. Hank immediately sprang forward with a stream of oaths so far-fetched that Simpson did not recognize them as English at all, but thought he had lapsed into some Indian or some other lingo. He only realized that Hank's presence, thrust thus between them, was welcome, uncommonly welcome. Dr. Cathcart, though more calmly and leisurely, advanced behind him, heavily stumbling. Simpson seems hazy as to what actually was said and done in those next few seconds, for the eyes of that detestable and blasted visage peering at such close quarters into his own utterly bewildered his senses at first. He merely stood still. He said nothing. He had not the trained will of the older men that forced them into action in defiance of all emotional stress. He watched them, moving as though behind a glass, and half destroyed their reality. It was dreamlike. It was perverted. Yet through the torrent of Hank's meaningless phrases, he remembers hearing his uncle's tone of authority, hard and forced, saying several things about food and warmth and blankets, whiskey and the rest, and further, that whiffs of that penetrating, unaccustomed odour, vile yet sweetly bewildering, assailed his nostrils during all that followed. It was no less a person than himself, however, less experienced and adroit than the others though he was, who gave instinctive utterance to the sentence that brought a measure of relief into the ghastly situation, by expressing the doubt and thought in each one's heart. "It is you, isn't it, Defago?" he asked under his breath, horror breaking his speech. And at once Cathcart burst out with a loud answer before the other had time to move his lips. "Of course it is, of course it is. Only, can't you see he's nearly dead with exhaustion, cold and terror? Isn't that enough to change a man beyond all recognition?" It was said in order to convince himself as much as to convince the others. The overemphasis alone proved that. And continually, while he spoke and acted, he held a handkerchief to his nose. That odour pervaded the whole camp. For the Defago who sat huddled by the big fire, wrapped in blankets and drinking hot whiskey and holding food in wasted hands, was no more like the guide they had last seen alive than the picture of a man of 60 is like a daguerreotype of his early youth in the costume of another generation. Nothing really can describe that ghastly caricature, that parody masquerading there in the firelight as Defago. From the ruins of the dark and awful memories he still retains, Simpson declares that the face was more animal than human, the features drawn about into wrong proportions, the skin loose and hanging, as though he had been subjected to extraordinary pressures and tensions. It made him think vaguely of those bladder faces blown up by the hawkers on Ludgate Hill that change their expression as they swell and as they collapse amid a faint and wailing imitation of a voice. Both face and voice suggested some such abominable resemblance. But Cathcart, long afterwards, seeking to describe the indescribable, asserts that thus might have looked a face and body that had been in the air so rarefied that the weight of atmosphere being removed, the entire structure threatened to fly asunder and become incoherent. It was Hank, though all distraught and shaking with a tearing volume of emotion he could neither handle nor understand, who brought things to a head without much ado. He went off to a little distance from the fire, apparently so that the light should not dazzle him too much, and shading his eyes for a moment with both hands, shouted in a loud voice that held anger and affection dreadfully mingled, "You ain't Defago! You ain't Defago at all! I don't give a damn, but you ain't my old pal of 20 years! He glared upon the huddled figure as though he would destroy him with his eyes. "And if it is, I'll swab the floor of hell with a wad of cotton wool on a toothpick, so help me, good God!" He added this with a violent fling of horror and disgust. It was impossible to silence him. He stood there, shouting like one possessed, horrible to see, horrible to hear, because it was the truth. He repeated himself in 50 different ways, each more outlandish than the last. The woods rang with echoes. At one time, it looked as if he meant to fling himself upon the intruder, for his hand continually jerked towards the long hunting knife in his belt. But in the end, he did nothing, and the whole tempest completed itself very shortly with tears. Hank's voice suddenly broke. He collapsed on the ground, and Cathcart, somehow or other, persuaded him at last to go into the tent and to lie quiet. The remainder of the affair, indeed, was witnessed by him from behind that canvas, his white and terrified face peeping through the crack of the tent door flap. Then Dr. Cathcart, closely followed by his nephew, who so far had kept his courage better than all of them, went up with a determined air and stood opposite the figure of Defago huddled over the fire. He looked him squarely in the face and spoke. At first, his voice was firm. "Defago, tell us what's happened, just a little, so that we can know how best to help you," he asked in a tone of authority, almost of command. And at that point it was command. At once, afterwards, however, it changed in quality. For the figure turned up to him a face so piteous, so terrible, and so little like humanity, that the doctor shrank back from him as from something spiritually unclean. Simpson, watching close behind him, says he got the impression of a mask that was on the verge of dropping off, and that underneath they would discover something black and diabolical, revealed in its utter nakedness. "Out with it, man! Out with it!" Cathcart cried, terror running neck and neck with entreaty. "None of us can stand this much longer." It was the cry of instinct over reason. And then Defago, smiling whitely, answered in that thin and fading voice that already seemed passing over into the sound of quite another character. "I seen that great Wendigo thing," he whispered, sniffing the air about him exactly like an animal. "I've been with it too." Whether the poor devil would have said more, or whether Dr. Cathcart would have continued the impossible cross-examination cannot be known, for at that moment the voice of Hank was heard yelling at the top of his voice from behind the canvas that concealed all but his terrified eyes. Such a howling was never heard. "His feet! Oh God, his feet! Look at his changed feet!" Defago, shuffling where he sat, had moved in such a way that for the first time his legs were in full light and his feet were visible. Yet Simpson had no time himself to see properly what Hank had seen, and Hank was never fit to tell. That same instant, with a leap like that of a frightened tiger, Cathcart was upon him, bundling the folds of blanket about his legs with such speed that the young student caught little more than a passing glimpse of something dark and oddly massed where moccasined feet ought to have been, and saw even that but with uncertain vision. Then, before the doctor had time to do more, or Simpson even to think of a question, much less ask it, Defago was standing upright in front of them. He was balancing with pain and difficulty, and upon his shapeless and twisted visage an expression so dark and so malicious that it was, in the true sense, monstrous. "Now you've seen it too," he wheezed. "You've seen my fiery, burning feet. And now, that is, unless you can save me and prevent, it's about time for—" His piteous, beseeching voice was interrupted by a sound that was like the roar of the wind coming across the lake. The trees overhead shook their tangled branches. The blazing fire bent its flames as before a blast, and something swept with a terrific, rushing noise about the little camp and seemed to surround it entirely in a single moment of time. Defago shook the clinging blankets from his body, turned towards the woods behind, and with the same stumbling motion that had brought him, was gone. Gone before anyone could move muscle to prevent him. Gone with an amazing, blundering swiftness that left no time to act. The darkness positively swallowed him, and less than a dozen seconds later, above the roar of the swaying trees and the shout of the sudden wind, all three men, watching and listening with stricken hearts, heard a cry that seemed to drop down upon them from a great height of sky and distance. "Oh, oh, this fiery height! Oh, oh, my feet of fire, my burning feet of fire!" And then died away into untold space and silence. Dr. Cathcart, suddenly master of himself, and therefore of the others, was just able to seize Hank violently by the arm as he tried to dash headlong into the bush. "But I want to know, you," shrieked the guide. "I want to see. That ain't him at all, but some devil that shunted into his place." Somehow or other, he admits he never quite knew how he accomplished it, he managed to keep him in the tent and to pacify him. The doctor, apparently, had reached the stage where reaction had set in and allowed his own innate force to conquer. Certainly, he managed Hank admirably. It was his nephew, however, hitherto so wonderfully controlled, who gave him the most cause for anxiety. For the cumulative strain had now produced a condition of lachrymose hysteria, which made it necessary to isolate him upon a bed of boughs and blankets as far removed from Hank as was possible under the circumstances. And there he lay, as the watches of that haunted night passed over the lonely camp, crying startled sentences and fragments of sentences into the folds of his blanket. A quantity of gibberish about speed and height and fire mingled oddly with biblical memories of the classroom. "People with broken faces, all on fire, are coming at a most awful, awful pace towards the camp," he would moan one minute, and then the next would sit up and stare into the woods, intently listening, and whisper, "Terrible in the wilderness are the feet of them that—" until his uncle came across to change the direction of his thoughts and to comfort him. The hysteria, fortunately, proved but temporary. Sleep cured him just as it cured Hank. Till the first signs of daylight came, soon after 5 o'clock, Dr. Cathcart kept his vigil. His face was the colour of chalk, and there were strange flushes beneath his eyes. An appalling terror of the soul battled with his will all through those silent hours. These were some of the outer signs. At dawn, he lit the fire himself, made breakfast, and woke the others, and by 7 they were well on their way back to the home camp, 3 perplexed and afflicted men, but each, in his own way, having reduced his inner turmoil to a condition of more or less systematized order once again. Well, that's it for today. Opening music was provided by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project, and this file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk